views are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Defiant Hustle Radio. I'm Noreen, and I'm really glad you're here with me tonight. I was walking over here in the pouring rain from my office at the top of Greenwich Avenue, and I was coming over here to the WGCH station, just a few blocks away, but it was pouring rain, and I was holding my backpack above my head so I wouldn't get soaked, and I snuck out for a second because the rain was coming down so hard in this little corridor between buildings, and I looked out over the WGCH station and by the post office here in town, and there was this beautiful rainbow. So sorry, Bob Small. I got two men in the studio with me tonight, guys, and one of them's giving me the stink eye or rolling his eyes at me.
I am? Must be me.
That's Bob. So Bob runs everything over here WGCH, so welcome, Bob.
Thank you.
And you're making fun of me?
No, I'm thinking to myself, I missed it.
Oh, well, I got a picture of it, so I took a picture. So, and then I have an incredible guest in the studio with me this evening, and I really am thrilled that he's here with me, and I'm honored that he's here with me. His name is Joseph Dermody.
Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
He's incredible. He's very humble, and I'm going to have to get him to come out of his humility a little bit. But he is an artist. You're a painter.
Correct.
You are a musician.
Correct.
You play the piano.
Yes.
You play the viola.
Yes.
You play the violin.
Yes.
Anything else in the musician department? In the music department?
Piano, violin, viola. You got it.
Okay. So then you make artwork.
Yes, abstract artwork in a local studio.
Okay, and then you also make furniture.
Yes, I like to design and dabble in furniture construction with a few collections here and there. Yeah.
See what I mean? He's like so like, yeah, no problem. All right, the rest of us can't do that, so we're impressed. But and you live here in Greenwich.
I do, 15 years now.
15 years. Where did you grow up?
Rhode Island.
Rhode Island.
I made my way over here for music school. And stayed.
You came to Connecticut for music school?
I came to New York, and then when I was out of school looking for an apartment, I landed in Greenwich.
Oh, wow. So, okay, we're just the microphone here. So let's just go back for a second. You grew up in Rhode Island.
Grew up in Rhode Island.
And so as you grew up, you just understood that you were a musician, or what happened?
I was always in music from an early age, and it just stuck with me. And then through high school, being very involved in lots of different musical ventures, and then went to undergrad, where I developed more of an understanding that I was going to be a musician. And then
you went to undergrad where?
I started at UConn.
Okay.
Up in Storrs.
Okay.
Not really knowing if I was going to study music, maybe study neuroscience.
Okay, we were going to talk about neuroscience and music in a little
maybe
bit.
Maybe I was going to study architecture, which doesn't shock me these days. I thought all those interests were very separate. But neuroscience and music, I've learned over teaching over the past, 15, 20 years that it's you can see brain activity while teaching.
Even architecture has
yes.
a visual
and architecture
spatial.
For me, it's layers and it's building and it's construction, and it's what I do now as an artist is sort of through my passion of passions of architecture is a lot of my artwork is using layers and structure. Even if it's an abstract form, I can see my past interest for architecture through there. But I went to school in Connecticut and then went back to Rhode Island and stayed with my parents for a bit and finished school out there with a mentor that I had known previous. And then that prepared me to come to graduate school and live in New York.
You had a mentor that was helping you with
My music teacher, I guess you could say, but my viola coach.
Your viola coach.
Who was more than just a teacher. He was more of a mentor. And he's a visual artist and a painter and a violinist and a pianist. And I was like, oh, I'm just becoming this guy that I've known my whole life. I was always fascinated by him and everything he did. And
Where does somebody go with the ability to play the viola? I mean, you were concerned. Were you actually concerned that you wouldn't be able to make money, or did that ever
I guess
occur to you?
After graduate or getting into graduate school, I always played the viola, and I made a little bit of money playing viola in school. And I didn't think twice about becoming a musician. It wasn't like a tough decision or an anxious decision. And then after I got out of grad school, which was in viola studies, and my master's in viola and orchestral performance, I realized that I needed to make money as a violist. And, you know, you're in school and you make a network and you're constantly working and gigging and, you know, you're doing an orchestra job here and then your friends are auditioning for an orchestra job there. And you just kind of, it's a network like any other network, and you learn through the network and you get jobs through the network. And a lot of freelance musician work is through networking. And it's not like sending your resume out and getting hired by a 9-to-5 office, you know. And my music network now is still very strong in and out of New York and Connecticut and New Jersey. And but I landed in Greenwich after grad school because the apartment that I found happened to be here. And then I started teaching and building a teaching studio. Teaching at some local stores, and then through word of mouth, having my own students, and that keeps me here. I value living and working in a community that I live in.
You're a part of this community because you've been featured in the Greenwich newspapers somewhat regularly.
People tell me all the time, they see me in the newspaper, and they always clip it out for me, and it's either an art show, because I participate in a lot of art shows, and
you're part of the Greenwich Arts Council?
Greenwich Arts Council, yep, which is a big umbrella for a lot of other organizations, but they started my career as an artist. There's a local show called Art to the Avenue that I participated in 2009, and then I just kind of took it from there and was interested in doing another art show, but I always came back to the Greenwich Art Show, and I just had my 10-year Art to the Avenue anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
And had been in such great stores like Richards and Tesla and Steinway, which was an amazing collaboration that I got to show artwork in a piano store, which was incredible because
they featured your artwork this year.
This year it was great. Yeah.
And you're a teacher, because I forgot to
say, so
you're a teacher to students throughout Greenwich.
Right, and that's what I was building when I first moved here. And now most of my clients and students and business and teaching is in Greenwich, where I travel to homes and work with students of all ages from 3 to probably 75.
Oh, really? You have 75-year-old
students? At one point. Maybe not right now.
Well,
sorry. Thinking about all my teaching and my students, but that's so when I moved here 15 years ago, built the studio, and in the meantime, about 5 years after building the studio,
Harold Avenue Studios.
That's a new studio.
Okay.
That's my art studio in town on Harold Avenue, where I create my own artwork and have people over to do collaborations in music and arts. It's part of my residence. It's just a residential studio.
Okay.
But when I say studio, or like when teachers talk about their studio, they mean their umbrella of teaching. Like all of my students is called my studio.
Sorry, I'm going to be very naive here,
Jason. Oh, it's like when I talk to people that I don't know, who I say my children, and I talk about my 30 children, and they look at me like, you have 30 children. No, teachers talk about their students as their kids. But I built that in town here and still teach. And then after about 5 years, a local cellist who I knew at the time was also a painter, and she said, we should do the local art show. And I kind of shrugged my shoulders and said, okay, I've created a few pieces of art in the past few years. And that's when I got associated with the Arts Council, and that was 10 years ago.
And a few pieces of art for you means it's definitely the paintings, which...
Originally, it was just a few sculptures made out of paper. Okay. I glued newspaper to canvas and painted it, and it looks like porcelain, three-dimensional porcelain.
You can see Joseph Dermody, D-E-R-M-O-D-Y, .com. You can see his work on there.
Correct. Old works, new works, a little bit of music, and my trio, and what we do as musicians, and...
A lot of your paintings, and I don't know what other pieces of artwork, and your sculptures, I guess they're in homes around the backcountry of Greenwich. And
many homes. people will send me pictures. I went to see my friend, and I took this photo. And some of the people that I do know, some people I don't know because they've sold through, you know, galleries like C. Parker or through friends of mine that have gifted, and they just kind of... They pop up in mysterious places.
We met one time, and just happened that I had Greenwich Magazine at my office, and you looked and you opened it up.
I was just waiting, and I opened it up, and the first page was a house for sale, and I thought, that looks familiar. That's my artwork.
Yes.
I wonder if it's selling with the house.
It was great. That's really admirable. So good for you. Why do you think some artists are successful? Is it always the talent of the artist, or is it just their ability to market themselves?
I love marketing too, and I do think marketing is what sells things. It's what gets it into the public eye. It gets people interested. I think marketing is huge, and there's obviously lots of talented artists. I'm sure everyone knows an artist that they say, oh, you should sell here, you should sell there, but it's not as easy as saying, oh, you should go down to the local gallery and give them your art. You know, you have to make relationships, and you have to get out of your house, and it's really marketing that sells anything. Art just happens to be an artist's product. And I really enjoy marketing. I think it's really fun, creative marketing.
And how does an artist market themselves if they're not going through a gallery?
These days, any social media platform is a great way to start. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I use Instagram a lot because it's visually based. I mean, Facebook is too, but Instagram is all about pictures. I have a lot of fun taking my artwork and either installing it in a beautiful home and taking beautiful pictures, because the environment that you create around anything is also what sells your product. So if I put a piece of artwork in someone's basement and take a picture of it, put it in a beautiful home and stage it, and just like you stage a house to sell, you stage a painting to sell, and it'll just get so much more traction. And you can do that with some free apps. Nothing that I do is really too fancy. So I've downloaded some free apps where I can mix and match different photos of beautiful homes and artwork of mine. And yeah, when you stage something, it definitely gets more traction. And that's just one of my fun late night marketing tactics.
I would have to imagine a lot of people that are really very talented just don't know how to get their work out there. Because
right,
what
having
are you
a website
to,
and having a nice website,
yes.
and having a clear website, and you know, not being too outdated. Or
what about pricing it? So you let me just, you're going to paint something, for example, and so all of a sudden it hits you one day that you're going to paint something, or somebody hires you to paint something.
Sometimes I'll wake up to an email and it'll say, I was given your name by so-and-so, saw your artwork, would love to talk to you about a commission. Or I'm a designer. A recent email was, I'm a designer in Boston. I have no idea how he saw my work. And he said, I saw this particular picture. He screenshot it and sent it in the email and said, I would like to use this in my work. Can we talk? Or sometimes you just post on social media and then you get a message on social media that says, I loved this photo. Sometimes, and you know, you start with your friends and your family. Those are, you know, your closest network. We were just talking about that off air. And you use the base, the marketing base that you have. I created a newsletter. I have someone in my family who is heavily into making and developing newsletters for other companies. And he said, you know, you should have a newsletter. And this was maybe 8 years ago. And I thought, what am I going to put in a newsletter? I have nothing to say. And then my first newsletter was basically, I create some art. I create some music. And everyone's always asking, what are you doing? When's your next concert? What are you doing? When's your next concert? When's your next art show? So my newsletters were just, here's my next art show. Here's my next concert. And come. And then over time, that's morphed into, here's my latest collection.
How did you get onto Property Brothers, the TV show Property Brothers? Because I saw that.
Yeah, that was a really fun project with a local designer, Ryan Smith. And he knew a friend of mine, and that friend was over at his house, and he was talking about needing an artist. I think it was the opening night of Art to the Avenue one year, maybe about 4 or 5 years ago. And she said, you know, go to this shop. He's there, and he will, you know, he was had all this artwork, and I guess it was from an art store, big box art store, big box home store, without mentioning too many names. And he found out he couldn't use any of the artwork because it was through the store, and he didn't have the rights of the artist, the rights for the store. So he needed someone who just gave him, you know, the rights. And I said, sure, come to my studio, which was in Stanford at the time. And just picked whatever, and we went to the house together in Norwalk, and it was really fun. You can watch the episode. I think, oh gosh, if you Google it, I really should know what episode and what season it is.
I think it's on your website.
Okay.
And I wanted to talk, before we move on, because we're going to talk about some composers, the three Bs, and then we're going to get into neuroscience and its effect on the brain. But before we go there, I wanted to ask you, of course, because I do business coaching, how does an artist, you get a call from somebody in Boston, or you get an email and they say, I saw your work and I'd like something made like this. Mm-hmm. And how do you turn around and, well, how long does it take you to paint something?
I have a couple different collections. Some, like my first early collections, would take like 30, 40, 50, 60 hours just because they were long-term projects. They took a lot of different steps in creating them. I have some newer abstract paintings that have to happen all before the paint dries. And though I can go back to it, the intention is that it's a burst of energy and it all comes out in one evening.
It's just like you're channeling something.
Exactly. And some of the sculptures that I'm more known for that hang on walls, take time if they need to be painted. There's just steps and drying times, and then I'll put something together, a sculpture together, and then I'll have to pull it apart because I'm not happy with the shape that it's created. It depends if things come out as I want them to come out in a fair amount of time.
You see, you know what you're... You generally know? I imagine you, of course, generally
there's
know.
There's a vision.
There's a general vision or a very precise vision?
If someone says, I want a copy of this, and I'll say I'll do my best to replicate the impression that you get from that painting.
But you do abstracts.
I do abstracts. But even in abstract, there is a vision, and then there's the structure to that vision, or how am I gonna go from a blank canvas? And that's the guidance we can talk about, you know, maybe more musically teaching, but the guidance of helping someone learn what those layers are so they can then have the freedom to create their own.
Okay, so we'll go there in a second. Right. Now, you get all done with it, and you say this is worth... And because, I mean, when I coach people, a lot of people have trouble valuing their services.
Yeah, I think it is one of the hardest questions about how do you put a number sign to a value.
And feel that you're worth it. So
at
some point, the public's recognizing, as in your case,
that
there's value here.
Right. And that happens over time. And I think with any business, that happens over time. You may start out as a mom and pop bakery selling at a farmer's market. And then you might turn into, you know, Starbucks, or you might turn into some huge corporation. Like most big corporations started out as one little shop in one little town. Mm-hmm. And then they just got momentum underneath and a good team. But I think you have to value yourself. You have to see your market, what your market is. If I went to a different market and,
you know, charge Greenwich,
and tried to charge, you know, too much, or if I tried to go to a high-end market and charge too little, then there's a look of why aren't you valuing yourself? Value is a great word because it's associated with a monetary number, but it's more of the value can increase through experience and through, I don't want to say awards, for lack of a better word, but you get an award for this and then your value is increased, and you get noticed for this and you get spotlighted on that and your value increases. So in the beginning, I was uncomfortable charging $50 for a painting, and someone would go, $50? And especially if they liked it, they would think, why $50? And I'm like, well, I haven't sold anything yet. So I don't think I can charge 500 or 500,000 or whatever. You know, artwork goes from a dollar to the millions and billions in the art world has probably the largest financial spectrum.
So I want to switch topics, but first I want to. So is your desire? You seem like you just sort of go with the flow each day. So it's you don't seem like you're ambitious, but you don't seem egotistical. But are you aiming to become somebody whose artwork is your goal to become somebody whose artwork is worth millions upon millions of dollars?
Or I wouldn't run like, away whatever. From that idea.
No doubt.
But I think in my life and experience, I like for things to happen organically.
Yes.
And things do happen organically for me. And I do get an email that says, I'm interested in this. And then I run after that. And I go towards that. And then that turns into something else. And as much as I want something to happen organically, I don't just sit back completely in a lazy state, wait for it to happen. Uh-huh. But at the same time, as people have told me, you know, things fall into your lap. And things do fall into my lap. But then I feel creative enough and in a way to then take what falls into my lap and make it more or make it bigger or turn it into something.
And you don't scare the hell out of yourself. Like, yeah. A lot of people get very afraid of the future and whether they're going to make it and things like that. Yeah, I do think because you seem to me, for what I know of you, to live very much in the present.
Yeah.
And maybe that is, we're going to talk about neuroscience a little bit later, but maybe that's part of the development of the brain that we know about when you do study music at an early age.
Sure. And it's a kind of an organic process. Maybe that has come through music education and then developed into the freedom of sort of non... my training is not in art, so maybe the freedom of not being put in a box. I talk to a lot of artists who find difficulty getting out of a box they've been put in through schooling and not having gone through
a box,
like you have to do this, you have to follow these rules, you're an artist, you have to do this. I didn't go through that training, so I don't know what those things are, so I don't follow
that
those rules.
Starving our artist's
right.
mentality.
Right. Whereas a classical musician, it is a box and you have to conform to things if you want to achieve certain things musically, unless you're
right,
a complete freestylist.
It is about conforming to what the community projects onto you about what's possible. And a lot of people, the majority of the people fall in line with that. And I would think if, as an artist, if you don't figure out some way to break out, I mean, unless you're just discovered, but that there you really have to go out there with an intention to make things happen. I don't know what you're doing. I do know that you put your artwork into different shows, or what are they called?
Art shows.
Art shows, and you just went.
Yeah.
So you're your
that has happened, and I have no control over that. It's always flattering. At the same time, I've applied to dozens of art shows and get rejected. And then one day I got an acceptance letter from a show and told that I was won not only first place, but best in show. And the same day I got two rejection letters from another show from similar works. So it really depends on who's looking at your work, what their intention is, what their intention of curating the show is. Uh-huh. You just never know. You kind of take what you get and learn how to work with it.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to take a break. I'm here talking with the artist, the musician, and the teacher, Joseph Dermody. And we're going to come back and we're going to talk about some of the great composers, the three Bs.
Thanks,
we'll be right back.
Good evening. If you're traveling the northbound Connecticut Turnpike from the state line up to Route 7, that is a 45-minute ride. The northbound side of the Merritt Parkway from Greenwich up to Norwalk, that's going to take 36 minutes. You can change the world for a child in extreme poverty through Compassion International. Just text CHILD to 83393 to find out how. I'm Jay Trelace in the 1490 WGCH Traffic Center.
From the WGCH Weather Center.
Showers and thunderstorms coming to an end in the evening hours. A few at or near severe levels early. Partial clearing with patchy fog late. Tonight lows 70 to 75. Tomorrow partly sunny with an afternoon shower. A few thunderstorms near 85. Any storms end tomorrow night. Becoming partly cloudy, cooler and less humid. Lows 60 to 65. Friday clouds give way to increasing sunshine, 75 to 80, and sunny near 75 Saturday. I'm meteorologist Ryan Gallagher on 1490 WGCH.
What if I told you I could change your life in just 100 days? This is Noreen Ehrlich from Defy and Hustle Radio. I'm an executive coach based in Greenwich, Connecticut. For over two decades, I worked as a CFO and leader in Wall Street's fast-paced private equity industry. I helped guide teams of professionals to improve their careers, grow their businesses, and still maintain work-life balance. Based on this know-how and my unique understanding of life's principles, I created a 100-day plan that will unquestionably uplevel your life. Make 2019 your year. You can and deserve to have it all. Don't wait. Take advantage of my free 50-minute consultation by visiting my website at noreenerlich.com or calling me at 475-333-2173. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Defiant Hustle. This is Noreen Ehrlich, and I'm here in the studio tonight with the artist and musician and teacher and businessman, Greenwich local Joseph Dermody.
Thanks, Noreen.
So, Joe, we were going to talk about, that was just Beethoven.
That was just Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven. Very famous piece.
Very famous piece. And there's something called the three Bs, mm-hmm. which is
Bach, Beethoven, Brahms.
And Brahms. And so I wanted to spend a little bit of time. You teach piano.
I do.
And I wanted you to talk to me, talk to our listeners, and explain a little bit about the differences between the composers and their periods and what might have motivated them to compose music in a certain way or whatever you want to talk about.
Great.
Brahms.
Really know where the three B's came from. Probably an easy Google search for me, but why the three B's, except that they're three composers from three different periods who are probably the most famous from their period. Periods like the Baroque period, which mm-hmm. is Bach, the Classical period, which is early Beethoven, and the Romantic era or the Romantic period, which would be Brahms. And there's little, you know, eras in between, and the 20th century era from the past 100 years, and now we're in the 21st century, which is what is modern music.
What is it now?
It's 21st LA century music blink. Is very, even in the classical realm, I mean, 20th century was very avant-garde. Mm-hmm. This is not with Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms. They were before this. That's what led up to it. But 20th century was very avant-garde, very experimental. A lot of people would think about just like noise patterns and sound patterns and a lot of mathematical thought processes. And it was all experimentation. And a lot of it sounded like it was very experimental. And 21st century, even though we're not too far into it, and it's hard to kind of see an era while it's happening until, you know, it's past. But I've noticed in the past almost 20 years, there's a lot of fusion of between composers, between styles, between not just classical music, but classical music and pop music
and
jazz. And there's
and also electronic. You
know, electronic music. And I think this is not just for music. I think it's culturally, there's a lot of fusion in art. There's a lot of fusion in pop culture.
That's probably for marketing purposes too, because they're doubling up on the marketing as the music industry started to fall apart.
Right, and it's not just like bringing back the 80s and the 90s, which is, you know, is all the rage. But in music specifically, there's a lot of fusion now. But and it does go all the way back to Bach and pre-Bach, which would be like the Renaissance period.
So Bach is 1600s.
1600s and the Baroque period, and he was in Germany, and he was basically employed by a church who asked him to write new music every week for services that were probably over an hour long. And he was just completely prolific writing for singers and choirs and string players and anything you can think of. And I don't know if he was very famous or well known at his time. I think a lot of his music went into a box and went into an attic and wasn't really experienced until hundreds of years later, when a composer that was more synonymous with between Beethoven and Brahms was a composer named Mendelssohn, and he I don't know if he found the music or if he was at this church in Germany or how it came about, but he was the one to really pull out Bach's music.
Mendelssohn found his music.
Yeah, Felix Mendelssohn, and he is a famous composer in and of himself, but he really pushed Bach on the masses, and it's the reason why we study Bach now as the forefather of all music.
Did the pipe organ exist at that time?
Yeah. Yes, Bach wrote a lot for the pipe organ. And I think then it was strictly, I think the pipe organ was, it was the church organ. It's still one of the biggest instruments. If you really look at a pipe organ that uses air, and I mean, they're the size of buildings because the pipes are, you know, 70 feet tall. And that's just for one note, each pipe on the organ, just for one note, not to go off on a tangent. But you go back into an organ.
If it's a low note.
Yeah. The tiny little notes are always these little toothpick size.
So Bach was playing in more religious, more religious period.
Yes, his context was writing for the church, though a lot of his music was outside of the church. I'm thinking of pieces that weren't necessarily sacred. I don't think all of Bach's music is specifically sacred.
Oh. Let's go to Beethoven.
Sure.
Now, Beethoven was
kind of go through a little bit past Mozart. And jump over to Beethoven. Mozart was...
I know, Mozart. Sorry, Mozart. You didn't mean that.
Yeah, we're jumping over Mozart. And the only reason he would be tied being in Austria is that he would have been a little bit older than Beethoven, and Beethoven would have considered him someone to look up to. And a lot of early Beethoven, if you listen to very early Beethoven, you might think to yourself, is this Mozart? Is this Beethoven?
Why? What is...
There's a classical period sound, the phrase structure. It wouldn't take too much looking into a couple pieces to see how it's structured without getting too detailed. And you can hear that structure. In early Beethoven, you can hear the classical structure. And then Beethoven was known to be breaking those norms. And at the time, if you were going to a concert, you would expect to hear certain phrases. I don't know these days if you'd go to a concert and expect to hear a certain phrase structure, but at the time, if you didn't hear a certain phrase structure, you were probably put off. And I think that's why a lot of people were put off. At least in the history books, we're told about certain concerts and certain mentalities of Beethoven's time that really he really broke the norm and didn't give people what they expected in the concert hall.
It was more emotional too, right? It was.
He was known to be just a fiery guy, and it kind of came out in his music. Yeah, very temperamental. And this, I can't think of a particular symphony. And there's this there's a timpani roll, or a timpani is a big drum, and there's usually four of them. And, you know, you're listening to strings and strings and strings, and all of a sudden you hear boom, 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 timpani out of nowhere. And there are a lot of musicologists that write about their theories of Beethoven and his music and how he came out through his music, or how his personality came out through his music. And those drum beats were just his boisterous, like, fiery.
Prior to that, it was literature that people found to be the most expressive art.
Sure.
And then and then he came out and started to make connection with emotions, not from reading, but through music.
Exactly.
And part of that, maybe it wouldn't have been so.
Yeah, and I'm glad you just mentioned that, because that was a very easy way to how you would say the transition from classical period, Mozart, early Beethoven, into what we call the Romantic era, where music was more driven by emotion. And you could hear through Beethoven's music whether it was loud and boisterous. At the same time, Beethoven wrote some of the most beautiful, heart-wrenching melodies and pieces of music that are very not like his fiery,
thunderous
music. Yeah,
yeah.
And probably really solidified what the Romantic era was going towards, which leads you to Brahms, the third B, and Brahms music, speaking of, you know, heartfelt, every note, every transition. And there probably was a lot of structure, but it was more about going with the heart and going with the emotions, and music was led, composition was led by emotion and not so much structure.
Brahms was not always respected by his colleagues, I would say,
right,
because he was considered old-fashioned and inexpressive.
Yes, shockingly, because Brahms is actually one of the most expressive composers that you can listen to. If you've never heard of Brahms and you know of the classic lullaby that you might sing to a baby, that's Brahms. And that's like the household tune that Brahms wrote that anyone would know. I think he felt he had a lot to live up to, being a little bit older, and a lot of the history books will talk about how he didn't write his first symphony for a long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was coming after Beethoven, and he just felt like, I think he was very stressed about living up to Beethoven symphonies. And I don't know if Brahms's first symphony was a success. I mean, I think he was a success, but some composers had to like ease into that. I'm not sure of the history of Brahms's symphonies sometimes, whether they were just beloved at the first moment or...
I don't know. I'm not even going to go
there. Yeah, we're not talking musicology right now. But.
Yeah, that's... Well, let's talk a little bit about music. You said you wanted to study neuroscience initially.
Yeah, and originally I was very fascinated by the brain, and now that we're kind of going towards in our talk about neuroscience and how it relates to music. And there are so many things written about why music lessons are good, why studying an instrument is good, and not only for children, and this can go all the way to like the Mozart effect, which probably doesn't have to be Mozart. It's just the idea of classical music and the brain.
What's the Mozart effect?
The Mozart effect is about playing Mozart to like newborn babies will become more successful and happier and more intelligent people because they listen to Mozart. It's kind of very simple and far-reaching statement, but there's more research, like these lists that we have about how studying music does actually change the chemistry of your brain at any age.
It's supposed to build up the gray matter that connects the left hemisphere of your brain to the right hemisphere of
your
brain.
Right, so then your creativity can then influence your, you know, your logic. And I think, and that kind of goes back to entrepreneurship as an artist. And if you can connect your creativity to your logic or vice versa, I think you'll be a successful creative person no matter what your outlet is, whether it's painting or sculpting or music, or whether you're the best pianist in the world. You know, you could be the best piano in the world, and unless you have the best agent in the world, you know, or you've linked your logic, your left brain and right brain hemispheres, that, you know, you might still be locked on one side and just, you know, be using your talent and not have it get out there.
Well, obviously, when we were talking about this initially, I was bringing up people who are known, like even this Epstein, the one that's been in the news that I really don't want to talk about a lot,
sure.
But how some people, so that you, it's hard to judge people because some people don't ever, their reptilian part of their brain is still dominant, so they can't control their impulses. I'm not trying to make any excuses for Epstein or anybody
else.
Right,
but just about brain,
but just the way,
pathology.
Right, where we judge people, we judge people on their behaviors, and you're not excusing people's behaviors, but some people may not have developed their brains in a way that it's connected to the part of their brain that has emotional intelligence.
Right.
And so the reptilian part of their brain can still be very dominant and do some pretty dark things still. So
right.
I looked up, so we're going to go into how music strengthens the brain, but I did go back to look because they're about the parts of the brain. The reptilian brain in a human is the oldest of three parts of the brain and controls the body's vital functions, such as the heart rate, breathing, body temperature, and balance. And this is at the base of our brain stem. Mm-hmm. Sorry, folks. The limbic brain came after that, and that first emerged in mammals. And it's the part that records memories and behaviors. And it's the part that makes us emotional, because mm-hmm. when we think about a memory, we have an emotional reaction mm-hmm. to it. And the neocortex was the part of the brain that developed in primates. And it It's the part that contains the two large cerebral hemispheres that play such a dominant role. These hemispheres have been responsible for the development of human language, abstract thought, imagination, and consciousness, and developing our learning abilities. So when we talk about music, it's really supposed to be connecting the different parts of our brain so they're working in unison instead of disconnected from each
other. Right, that's exactly what I think of as a teacher, even when I'm meeting with a new student or their parents, and they say, you know, I don't think my kid is going to be a professional pianist. And I say, well, most people in the world are not going to be a professional pianist, but you don't not study math in fourth grade because you're not going to become a mathematician. Like, you just do it so not only are you well-rounded, but I think that term well-rounded is like your brain. You want a well-rounded brain. You want to be a well-rounded citizen making good choices. And I think the things you do growing up, especially when you're forming your brain, although I think brain activity and what you can do with your brain or what you can do to your brain is always changing. Mm-hmm. For better, maybe for worse. And I think studying an instrument and talking to these parents and having their students you mentioned emotional intelligence. And I think studying an instrument just requires you to be thoughtful. It requires you to learn sensitivity. It requires you to learn like puzzles and management of the puzzle and time management. Even though you're just learning how to manage a few notes within a few seconds, I mean, that's just sort of on a micro level. But on a macro level, that translates to managing your day and managing the things in your day. Like, your activities in your day are like your notes on the page.
Do you have adult students?
I do have many adult students, and they're much more difficult on themselves. But I think it's because they get the process, and they see the process, and they feel more responsible for the process. Even though I allow them to make the same mistakes as any age student or a younger student, except the younger student usually doesn't care. But you have to go through those processes. It's like people say, you learn from your failures.
Adult students are harder on themselves?
Quite.
Okay, I can relate to that because I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm very hard on myself.
Don't the adult students already have a sense that they want to do this, whereas the children not necessarily?
True, and even if the children
make that decision,
yeah, and the adult students want to do it, and adult students want to be good at it right away.
Yes,
and I think as a child at any age, you accept where you're at. And it's not like kids get frustrated too, but it's not in the same sense. There's more care as an adult, so you want to be able to make a successful choice and hear it when you're, you know, practicing the piano. I guess my goal and sort of passion as a teacher is to guide any student at any age through those moments of frustration and show them the little bits of progress you can make within 5 minutes and within 10 minutes and within 5 days and within 10 days and 5 months and 10 months and so on. And you see those progressions and those little bits of success. So then they're motivated to keep going and how to.
Do you have to spend
that.
A lot of time studying all the basics, like all the different chords? And
it comes with the territory. You, especially as a piano student.
Because that must be the
student.
Part that turns off, that would stop a child or an adult.
Right. It depends on the teacher and how methodic methodical the teacher is and how much they incorporate those things. There's plenty of literature in piano literature, musical literature, where you can learn about some chords and then you're immediately playing a small song with those chords. So you get to act out what you've just learned and you're not just learning A, B, and C and Do, Re, Mi, but you're implementing it on a small level. And then the next song you're learning, you learn something else that may be very methodical, but you get to incorporate the chords you just learned plus the new method that you're learning. It's kind of like chasing after the carrot, a bunny chasing after the carrot. I'm not sure if the bunny ever knows if they're going to get the carrot or it's just going to keep moving in front of them. Whereas music is kind of like that. You get better, it gets harder. You get better, it gets harder. You get better, it gets harder.
Did you ever play, Bob?
Yes.
You used to play piano?
I played cello up through high school.
Oh, did you?
I play the guitar now because I found the cello. The experience of learning it was at an age where I was learning all the details and had no sense of the creativity. of the sound.
I think that's
And the guitar at the time looked to me like the way to go to do that, so I put the cello aside, picked up the guitar. And now that I've learned as much as I have on the guitar, I want to go back to the cello.
Do you play the guitar?
I mean, all the time.
You've been playing for how long?
Oh, 30 years.
30 years.
Yeah.
So where do you play the guitar? I
don't
know this about you. You play it. You don't go out and try and play with the group or anything like that?
No. I did in my 20s, but I don't do it anymore.
And what do you play, rock and roll?
Fusion.
Okay.
It's just whatever's in my head, basically.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know this about you. You always sit there very quietly, and then you come up with stuff that I don't know about.
Uh-huh.
All right, good. Well, apparently, neuroscience and music, music has an impact on your basic sensory processes. So your audio,
audio, visual, and timing, and structure and form.
Movement.
Movement. Even if you're playing something that's
spatial.
Not on the page.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sound, quality, volume control. Things you're not, even children or even adults, you're not thinking about every little thing in the moment because you have this sense of what sounds good. You know, even a baby's listening to music from the time they're born. They get to an age, even 3 years old, where they can play something and they've experienced music, they've experienced volume control, and now they just learn how to do it themselves.
For older people who go out to play an instrument, it's supposed to improve, it's supposed to help maintain your hearing.
Absolutely, everything from hearing, probably sight as well, but just the brain function. There's so many articles and studies about, you know, keeping dementia or Alzheimer's at bay because you're using your brain so intently when you're studying music at any level.
It's like doing puzzles.
It is, and the less advanced you are, the more engaged you have to be and the more you're using your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know nothing about playing piano, that's the best time that's the best time to using your brain if you're not into Sudoku and crosswords. And the piano is nice because you're really implementing your brain. You don't even realize it because you're getting these sense of satisfactions out of it because you get to hear what you're playing.
And if you could just make it through certain periods of time, just like anything else, and even when I coach my clients, if you can just get through that tough period at the beginning,
exactly,
it starts to, you get through a certain period, and then all of a sudden it starts to come together a little bit.
True. And you see little successes along the way, even if you're doing something very basic or very fundamental,
mm-hmm.
you see how it works, you see how you can implement it, and that gets you excited to then implement that bigger puzzle piece smaller puzzle piece into a bigger picture.
So some of the other ways instruments or music strengthen your brain, it strengthens your bond with others because musicians are...
Sure, when you're playing, even if you're just playing a duet with your teacher or your buddy, or if you're playing in a band, you're connecting. You're not sitting at home by yourself. And learning the piano or instrument is a great way to spend time with yourself. But this particular case about bonding with others, I mean, you're creating something together. It's like you're all painting a painting that's going to be great at the end, and you all had something to do with it.
Even to have a teacher mentor you, you have to have a level of respect for your teacher, and it forces you to do something and respect somebody, which we don't always get anymore, where you actually have somebody who's far more talented than you, who's telling you what to do, and you're not getting antsy or something about it.
You know that you don't know as much and you're reliant on them to literally feed you information so you can grow. I mean, if your musical knowledge is in infancy, then you act musically like an infant, hopefully with less, screaming and crying and all those things. But you have a trust and respect.
You develop a bond.
Yeah.
And it's actually somebody who's guiding you instead of you resisting. People don't like being told what to do, but in this case, you have to be told what to do.
Yeah.
And you have to be very vulnerable in front of your teacher.
And that's a great way for even if it's instrumental, if it's music, if it's painting, at any creative outlet, to find someone that just knows a little bit more than you do. Even if it's a friend who plays the guitar and you know nothing and you just say, I want to go buy a guitar. So you go buy a cheap guitar and then have your friend just teach you what they know, even if they're not good at explaining it. They can just show you and you feel like you're back in first grade because you get to be an adult and you think, not that you think you know everything, but you survive by what you know. And you put yourself into a situation like music and musical training if you haven't had, And you really rely on someone just telling you, this is what you're going to do next, this is what you're going to do next. And it's kind of nice. Then you just, you're led by the guidance and you trust that you're going to get better.
You're being coached.
Right.
It improves memory and reading skills.
Absolutely.
And it makes you happy, generally speaking. Different types of music can have different effect, but generally it makes you happy.
I think that's from the little successes you get through seeing your progress and hearing a piece of music that you've always wanted to play, even if it's a simple version.
It says McMaster University discovered that babies who took interactive music classes displayed better early communication skills. They also smiled more.
That doesn't surprise me.
Musicians can process multiple things at once.
I read that and I took that as a little personal, a little pat on the back or a little ego stroke. And I'm like, yes, I'm a very good multitasker and it must be because I'm a musician. But that aside, I do agree. I talk about organists. I'm not an organist, but organists train themselves to play with two hands, not only on a keyboard. Most organists start out as pianists, but organs have anywhere from, they're called registers, I believe, in each keyboard. And they have anywhere from 2 to 3 or 4, sometimes 5, what you would see as a keyboard, that they're playing simultaneously, and their feet, and they're reading not just a right hand, left hand music notation, they're reading a right hand, left hand, right foot music notation. I think organists get the gold star for being able to multitask the best.
I don't even know who plays the organ anymore. Let's see, where you go to hear the organ other than maybe in a church.
A church, but yeah.
That's it, the best place.
Music increases blood flow to your brain.
That doesn't surprise me either because you're, you know, I think playing an instrument, I know for my violin or my viola, but for piano too, studies show how it raises your body temperature. It burns more calories. I think playing the piano for an hour burns like 100 calories, or playing the violin burns. I was shocked to find out playing the violin burns more than 100 calories.
It's like a meditation. Opens up some area of your brain that just makes you feel alive again afterwards.
Right. Yeah, maybe it's the hyper-focus. Maybe it's the, you know, a piano, you're not necessarily moving as much as when you're playing a violin, but it's just the level of concentration that, you know, your body is functioning at a higher frequency, which probably creates more blood flow.
Music helps the brain recover, and I think that our scientists are studying more about how sound and music frequency and sound frequency is helping people to recover, even especially stroke patients. And
I think that could be from everywhere from listening to music on a level to practicing the music. For the stroke patients, it might be more practicing the music because you're engaging yourself. And certain recoveries, you know, music therapy is an industry that's been around for a very long time and always developing about recovery with music.
Music reduces stress and depression. A study of cancer patients found that listening to and playing music reduced anxiety. And another study revealed that music therapy lowered levels of depression and anxiety.
I think music keeps you in the moment. If you're listening to it and you're enjoying it, you're in the moment. If you're practicing it, you're in the moment. And all meditation is about being in the moment and not worrying about the future, not worrying about the past.
That's why people keep their headphones on all the time and they walk in front of cars because they're on the avenue and they're just focused on their phones and their music. 1 minute. Music training strengthens the brain's executive function, and that's what we were talking about before. And that helps function covers critical tasks like processing and retaining information, controlling your behavior, your impulsive behavior, making decisions, and problem solving.
I think that's a great reason to just find your creative outlet, whatever it may be, and don't be afraid.
And not so much logic anymore and start to build up that intuitive side of your brain.
Yep, piano or art.
All right, we got to wrap it up, folks.
Thank you, Noreen.
This was Joseph Dermody. That's Bob Small telling me to wrap it up. I'm Noreen Ehrlich. This is Defy and Hustle Radio. Thank you very much and have a great week.
The Voice of Greenwich. This is 1490 WGCH Greenwich.
President Trump reversed course today on a tax cut.
I'm not looking at a tax cut now. We don't need it. We have a strong economy.
Yesterday, Trump floated a possible payroll tax cut amid a debate about whether the U.S. is heading for a slowdown that would threaten his reelection chances. Meanwhile, a new study